our first speaker this morning is Dr. Peter Singer. Dr. Singer was educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. He has taught at Oxford, Latrobe University, and Monash University, and since 1999 has been the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. From 2005 and on, he has also held a part-time position of Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne in the Center of Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. Among Dr. Singer's numerous publications are his books Animal Liberation, Practical Ethics, The Expanding Circle, Should the Baby Live, How Are We to Live, and The Life You Can Save. Dr. Singer was founding president of the International Association of Bioethics and founding co-editor of the journal Bioethics. Outside academic life, he is the co-founder and president of the Great Ape Project, an international effort to obtain basic rights for chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans. He is also president of Animal Rights International. Our second speaker is Dr. John Patrick. Dr. Patrick holds degrees from the University of London and St. George's Hospital Medical School in London. He has done extensive research into the treatment of childhood nutritional deficiency and related diseases, holding appointments in Britain, the West Indies, and Canada. He lectures widely at universities in Britain, North America, and the former Soviet Union and Africa, working with various international agencies and with the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. In 2002, he retired from his lengthy position as associate professor, clinical nutrition, Department of Biochemistry and Podiatrics, Pediatrics at the University of Ottawa. He speaks frequently to university groups on moral issues in medicine and culture and the integration of faith and science. He also is president of Augustine College, a one-year post-high school institution. And our third speaker is our own Professor Bruce Russell, who, as many of you know, has been in the philosophy department here at Wayne State for over 30 years, 10 as chair. He graduated from the University of California at Davis with a Bachelor of Science in Math and a PhD in philosophy. His areas of specialization are epistemology, ethics, philosophy of religion, and philosophy of film. Dr. Russell has published several papers on the problem of evil, an entry in A Priori Justification and Knowledge in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, a paper comparing moral with epistemic duty, and several papers on the philosophical limits of film. He recently has reviewed Paul Moser's The Elusive God for the Notre Dame Philosophical Review, and in the past reviewed Richard Swinburne's Providence and the Problem of Evil for Philosophical Books. Dr. Russell has been an active participant in various events dealing with religion, science, and philosophy over the years, and I got this biography from a debate that he did about the existence of God at Southeastern Bible College in Alabama earlier this year. So he has done a lot of this type of debating. Every one of us here probably has or probably should have questions on our minds as we listen to this discussion and debate. I know I will have several questions in the back of my mind as I listen not only to the words and the music, as it were, of our speakers this morning, but as I consider the ultimate source of authority for what each of us can possibly know truly about human worth. In fact, as I consider the question, the origin of human worth, do we need God to value humans, I'm reminded of the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden as narrated in the book of Genesis. Adam and Eve were forbidden by God to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The serpent, however, assured them that they could be God or as God. That is, they could effectively pretend to be gods by deciding for themselves on whatever basis they chose that which is good and that which is evil. But the question that is posed by millennia of human history continues to haunt us. What is the ultimate basis of good and evil? Who gets to decide? Who ought to decide? God, as revealed through His Word? Humans? Each of us, according to our own selective compassion and reasoning? Based on what? Human logic? History suggests to us that human logic is forever flawed and often and always suspect. Still, should we rely on the arguments of those who seem especially rational today until proven otherwise tomorrow? Or simply, should we listen to those in power or those who are more able to affect and influence a culture? Here this morning, we're asking a similar question and a very much related question. What is the basis and what is the origin of human worth? Is human worth intrinsic, that is an essential quality or condition that results from our very essence in who we are or how we're created or by whom we're created? Or is human worth extrinsic, that is, something that must somehow be argued about and decided and ultimately assigned by those in power within various cultures, political structures, time frames, and worldviews? Those are some of the philosophical questions, and in particular, epistemological questions, that I will have in mind this morning as I listen to these eminent scholars discuss human worth. So please join me now on this journey of active, inquisitive listening as we turn first to Dr. Singer.
Do you want to leave me the microphone? Is this coming over? Oh, yeah, fine. I don't need one. Good. Excellent. Thank you. So thank you very much, Professor Spaulding, for that introduction. And I want to thank the people who've organized this and put together. Hello? Yes? I want to thank particularly Frank Huxley, who I had a lot of email with in arranging this, who unfortunately is not able to be here with us today. So let's ask the question that we've got here, do we need God to value humans? My answer to that is no, we do not. And from my perspective, it's very fortunate that the answer is no, we do not, because I don't think that there is a God. So if we did need God to value humans, it wouldn't be possible to value humans, which would be an unfortunate state of affairs. But I do want to say something about the kind of value that I think we end up with if we're talking about how we value humans without believing in God. Let me just maybe say, although it's not exactly our topic, but 1 minute on why I don't think that there is a God. And when I say I don't think that there is a God, of course, people can mean all kinds of things by the term God. And some of them are so amorphous that you really couldn't intelligibly argue against such a concept. But when I'm talking about God, I essentially mean the Judeo-Christian conception of a creator of the universe who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. And I think that that is incompatible with the world that we see out there. It's incompatible because of the existence of suffering which is not simply the result of human free will. I know people often say that, well, God gave us free will and that's why he can't stop the existence of suffering. But there is suffering that has nothing to do with free will. There's the suffering of an infant who maybe is dying because there's been a drought and there's no food in the area, or of someone who's crushed by a falling rock that falls off a hillside or in an earthquake, and I don't think there's any way in which we're saying that, that could be the result of free will. I know that some religious people believe that this is the outcome of original sin, because Adam and Eve sinned. That's why every human must suffer, even undeservedly, and even not from human free will. Personally, I think that that would be an absolutely appalling, morally appalling conception of what God would do to people, that he would inflict suffering on the descendants under every generation because somewhere way back in what's supposed to be history, someone else committed a grievous sin. But even if you could swallow that appalling moral theology, what would you say about the suffering of non-human animals who are not descended from Adam and Eve and yet I think clearly are capable of suffering, clearly do suffer, and clearly do suffer on many occasions, although on many occasions they suffer because we humans inflict unnecessary pain and distress on them. They also suffer when they die in a drought, for example. And I cannot conceive how a God, as described in the Judeo-Christian tradition, could possibly have set up a world in which that happens. If you knew about this, if you had the power to stop it, and you were all good, why wouldn't you stop it? So that's essentially why I think we have to consider this question of valuing humans without believing in such a God. Now, in what way then do we value humans? Well, When I say that I think we can value humans and it's important to value humans, I think, firstly, as I guess is already clear from what I've said, that suffering matters, and conversely, enjoying your life matters. Suffering is a bad thing. I'm not saying that every case of suffering is always bad. Of course, sometimes suffering may have some redeeming value, may lead to overcoming that and to building character. But generally speaking, suffering is bad. And as I say, if a baby slowly suffers from hunger and dies in a famine, or if a baby is injured by a falling rock and then lingers and develops fevers and infections from the wound and then dies, I can't see any good, really, in that kind of suffering. And the same is true of the suffering of non-human animals. So I think suffering is generally a bad thing. And for beings, whether human or non-human, to enjoy their lives, to have fulfilling lives, is a good thing. So that's one way in which we can value humans as sentient beings, as beings who can enjoy their life or whose life can go badly. And we ought to be concerned about humans and non-human animals on that basis. We ought to be concerned about their suffering. And regrettably, often we're not sufficiently concerned about their suffering. The most recent book that I've written, The Life You Can Save, is about how little we are doing to help those who are living in extreme poverty in the developing world, and how we could do much more, and we could, I believe, dramatically reduce the suffering of the billion or so people living in extreme poverty in the world. But in fact, we do very little. The United States, although it's a nation of predominantly Christians, gives currently in official aid about 22 cents, I think the last figures I saw, in every $100 we earn as a nation. And if you add private aid to that, although it's a little difficult to work out how much that might be, maybe you get to 35 cents in every $100 we earn. It's pathetic. It's truly pathetic. And if we say we value human beings, it's difficult to really believe that we're sincere about that when we are giving such trivial amounts, when we spend far more on all kinds of luxuries that we don't need, when we spend far more on things like alcohol, let's say. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on alcohol each year as a country, and we're spending something like $30 or $35 billion on aid to those in extreme poverty. So it's hard to take seriously our profession of really being valuing humans and being concerned about human life, because we know that one of the results of extreme poverty is death. A shortened lifespan for all of those living in extreme poverty, a lifespan roughly 50 years rather than the 75 to 80 that people have in developed countries, and a very high rate of death of children under 5. So according to UNICEF's figures, currently something like 8.8 million children die every year, children under 5 die every year from poverty-related causes. That's something like 24,000 children dying every day, which, if we were serious about our concern for human life, I believe we would be doing far more about. And if you want to know more about that, you can either look at the book, or I'd encourage you to go to a website I've set up called thelifeyoucansave.com, where you can pledge to meet a standard I propose for how much we ought to give, which is quite a modest standard. Starts off at just 1% of income for most people, depending on income, but is still, as I say, many times what most Americans, despite claiming that they're Christians, actually give to help those in extreme poverty. So that's part of what valuing humans would mean. Now, you might ask, though, so far I've simply talked about suffering and happiness, lives going well, and that's a respect in which humans and non-human animals are comparable. That is, they're all capable of suffering. They're all capable of experiencing, enjoying their lives in some way. When I say all, let's say, just to make things easier, let's say we're talking about vertebrate animals anyway. I don't want to get into whether insects or oysters or animals like that can feel pain. Maybe they can't, but if we're talking about vertebrates, I think what I'm saying is safe. Now, you might say, but surely humans have some special value over and above non-human animals. And one of the questions we want to talk about today in this session and in other sessions we'll be talking about is, can we value humans as special beyond non-human animals without belief in God? My answer to that is, it depends on how you use the term human. That is a term that is also, I think, needs a little more precision, because people use it in different ways. Sometimes they use it to mean simply a member of the species Homo sapiens. And sometimes they use it rather differently, as when someone might say to someone who's behaved appallingly, sometimes you can imagine, say, a judge saying to a criminal who's committed horrific violent crimes, they might say, you have behaved in an inhuman way, or you've behaved like an animal, not like a human being, which is a slur on the way most animals behave, of course. But nevertheless, the point is that to be truly human, you have to have some characteristics that are above and beyond the fact that you're a member of the species Homo sapiens, because the person who says you've acted in an inhuman way, you haven't acted like a human being, of course, is not denying that you're a member of the species Homo sapiens. It doesn't think that you're a member of any other species. I draw this distinction because I now want to go on and say, I don't actually think that without belief in God, you can believe that simply being a member of the species Homo sapiens gives you any special moral value. I think the only way you could really justify that belief is if you hold the view that, let's say, God has given all members of the species Homo sapiens an immortal soul, and no other beings, no animals have immortal souls. Or that all members of the species Homo sapiens, in some sense, are made in the image of God, whatever exactly that might mean, and no other animal has that. Or that all humans have been given dominion over the animals, and no animals have been given dominion over anyone else. If you held those beliefs, none of which obviously I think are justified, because I don't think that there is a God, then I guess you could say, this is why I think every member of the species Homo sapiens has some special value. Even if you did tell that, I think you would want to ask why God would give every member of one particular species an immortal soul, let's say. I mean, you know, if you can ask that question at all. I don't get into that because I don't believe in God, so questions about why God would do something not something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. But I don't think on a non-religious basis you can say that membership, 2 minutes, okay, that membership of a particular species is really going to be morally crucial. What you can say is that having certain characteristics and capacities is morally important. So, for example, being the kind of being who lives over time, plans for the future, and hopes to achieve something in the future can be something of particular significance. And we might say that it's worse to kill a being who has thoughts about the future, is planning for the future, wants to achieve things. If you kill such a being, you cut off those hopes and plans, and you prevent that being from realizing those achievements. If you kill a being who lives only in the present, has no awareness of its future, and doesn't think about the future, you don't cut off any of those hopes or wishes or shorten life before that being can achieve what he or she wants to achieve. So I do think that there are differences, reasons why we can value most normal human beings above most non-human animals in terms of the wrongness of killing, not in terms of inflicting suffering on them. But This is clearly not going to apply to every member of the species Homo sapiens. For example, you have a baby born with a condition known as anencephaly. That is essentially only a brain stem, no cortex, no higher brain, no capacity for consciousness ever, not even the ability to recognize and smile at his or her mother when she comes into the room. I don't think there's a reason for valuing the life of that being, even though it's a member of the species Homo sapiens, above that of a non-human animal, which actually has higher intellectual capacities. And I know my time is up, so I'll sit down at that point. Thank you.
Some of you must be wondering what this idiot scientist is doing, allowing two philosophers to beat up on him. But some of you will be just sadistically enjoying the sequence. Others may see another point in it. It's not something I would have volunteered for. I was sort of pushed into it. Wayne State has done that to me several times, actually. It seems to be somewhere I come back to do things that I wouldn't do willingly. But the question of how we treat one another is not one that's unimportant to me. I have spent my life primarily with three groups of children. The children of the developing world with severe malnutrition. I've had an awful lot of 10-pound two-year-olds in my arms. Children with cystic fibrosis, who we are now removing before they are born, so that the prevalence has dropped by some 20% in North America since we got the gene. And children with severe metabolic disorders and things like cerebral palsy, who will never walk or talk or feed themselves. I think they have an important role in our society, and it's not an easy one to defend. I agree entirely with Peter Singer that, of course, it's perfectly obvious that you can be good and that you can care for people without believing in God. Buddhists don't believe in God, and they are fairly gentle people. Christians have done an awful lot of evil in the world, but so have all other groups. We were, my wife and I, that is, were caught up in the Rwanda war in 1994. My wife ended up running half a dozen refugee camps for 2 years. Our children had gone to university. We'd been in Africa every year for 10 years before that, for about my wife for 4 months and me for two. She's an Africophile. I had a project running on the borders of Rwanda. And I knew she wouldn't come back in September, because there were 6- and 7-year-olds trying to care for 3-year-olds. And she was a mother. And she didn't come back for 2 years. I went out there in the summer and had the most amazing summer of my life teaching in the refugee camps. First time in my life I actually said to God, this summer is yours. I didn't control the agenda. I wish I'd done it earlier. My wife knows I don't suffer from jet lag. And so I arrived and she said, I've arranged for you to meet the leaders of my refugee camps tomorrow. I said, you've done what? And she said, you heard. They need you. I said, what have I got to say to people who've lost everything and been through the most horrendous carnage, when I'm a comfortable professor living in Canada? And she said, you'll do just fine. Well, that's another story, but what happened was that next day I had a 3-hour talk with about 20 or 30 Africans before we got to the question, how was it that we who call ourselves Christian ended up killing one another? And I said, welcome to the club. All believing groups have done it at one time or another. Christians are by no means immune. The biggest killers in the recent past, of course, are those who believed in the utopian ideals of Marxism. But everybody has done it. It seems to be written into our character. I think I can prove that to you. Raise your hand if you are good. Now, the only place where I've had people raise their hand is in Alabama, which shook me for a moment. But then I realized it was the jocks in the back row, and I said, do you mean good in relation to some real objective value or in relation to the guy next to you? And of course it was the guy next to them. They were moral relativists to the core. Now, the rest of you didn't raise your hand because you knew if you did, somebody who knew you just a little bit would start laughing. And if they didn't, I would ask, where is your wife or your husband? None of us could walk around with a bubble over our head displaying our thoughts, could we? Just imagine, wouldn't it be fun if I could, just a Peter Singer, just to be malicious, say, boop, now every thought that he has in the rest of this day is readable by the rest of us. I mean, where's he going to go? He's certainly not going to debate me, probably lock himself in the toilet. That is human nature. Suffering is awful. It's a huge problem for Christians. I'm committed because I have no other way out of pie in the sky when you die. The only analogy I can give you that even vaguely comes close to how I would begin to deal with that, having spent my life with children who have suffered, is years ago I gave the smallpox vaccine to my children. Most of you have not had that. I happened to diagnose the last case of spontaneous smallpox in Europe. I wasn't immune at the time. Fortunately, the vaccine takes 5 days and the disease takes 13 days, so there was a window. But my children were too young to understand when I insisted that it be redone. And I made sure they got a really good vaccination. I didn't want a little blip that might be positive. They had good swelling. It was painful. They accepted it from me because they knew I loved them, not because they could understand it. I hope that I'm right, that I will see our history in this world one day from that kind of perspective. But it's only a hope, and I would acknowledge it's pie in the sky when you die. But we do have need of something to help us to care for one another. We all know we ought to. None of you have a problem with that. I don't know. I hope there'll be some good philosophical discussion from these clever guys about where these ideas come from. They appear to me to be hardwired. Children come into this world expecting fidelity from their parents. They have no power, apparently, but they can get you to the children's hospital in 10 minutes if they scream enough. They do have power, and we know we ought to do things for them. You all know what goodness is. Your problem doesn't lie in a problem of ignorance. It lies in a problem of the will. And that's why I need a God. I would not have done the things that I did without the faith that I have. That's what motivated me. And as my wife said, the first 3 weeks of dealing with thousands of people dying a day in Goma, literally most people could only stand 2 or 3 days of it before they had to fly back to Nairobi for some rest and resuscitation. She worked for 3 weeks. She couldn't pray. She couldn't read the Bible. She said the only thing that helped was realizing that Habakkuk had said to God once, "Why, O Lord, do you make me look upon injustice?" And he didn't answer the question. But as he gave Habakkuk the ability to endure, he gave Sally the ability to endure. Climbing over roadblocks made out of bodies is not easy. Now, so we need some help, I think. There are some people, Peter Singer is a very moral man as far as I can find, much better than me. I need help to achieve those things. Interesting enough, a few years ago, I had a very interesting moment of truth, of all places in Cuba. I've been to Cuba to teach a good many times. Initially it was to teach medicine, but I was also persuaded when I went the first time to teach pastors as well. And the government didn't stop it. In fact, a few years later, I was talking to the Minister of Health, and he said, "We know that you teach pastors as well. Just don't push the envelope." I did, and I didn't get a visa for a year or two, but then they allowed me back again. But on one occasion, after a lecture like this, but it was about medicine, a gentleman rather like Peter came up to me, a nice man who was obviously very smart, and then he put me on the spot. He said, "I'm the professor in charge of the Department of Marxism and Leninism in the local university. And we have been looking at Russia, and we realize that Russia collapsed because it lost its ethical core. As one student said to me once in the University of St. Petersburg, the problem with Marxism was that it destroyed the meaning of the word trust. It's hard to run a society without it." And this man, who loves Cuba, said, "I have stopped teaching Marxism. I'm teaching ethics, multicultural ethics. But the problem is the students go to sleep, which they usually do. He said, they don't go to sleep when you're teaching, I'm told. Will you debate me tomorrow morning in front of the faculty on the nature of human ethics? Now, I couldn't refuse. I thought I wouldn't make much progress, but I had an incredible experience. Obviously, the start of a debate matters. You have to engage the audience. And I had several starts that would work, but I also knew that there was a better one. I didn't know what it was. Now, how could I do that? Penrose writes about this at one point, where he remembers standing on the yellow line in the middle of Oxford High Street and suddenly seeing the solution to his morning's work. He was supposed to be going to a committee meeting, but he turns around and goes back to his office. It takes him all afternoon to write down what he saw in a microsecond. Well, that happened to me. I got to the lectern walking slightly further than this, that chair rather than this one, and the whole first 10 minutes of the lecture were changed in my head, just like that. Fortunately, I had a Colombian Canadian as a translator. I said, please write on the blackboard, this message assembled itself in Spanish, which he did. And then I asked the profs and everybody else, is this a grammatical sentence? And of course it is. I said, is it meaningful? And of course it isn't. It's rubbish. It has no meaning. This message assembled itself. It's nonsense. And I said, of course it is. And then I turned around and crossed out message and put in, this DNA assembled itself. And I said, but you do believe this sentence to be true. Yet DNA is not you and me. DNA is a message directing how you and me can be assembled. Isn't that amazing? Were you more right in your first assessment of the common sense sentence or your second one written in scientific gobbledygook? It is astonishing that at the heart of every cell in your body, there is a message written in about a meter of DNA that can be packed so incredibly well that you can't see it, and it makes you. And I've only got 2 minutes left. Sorry, I mistimed. That led to the whole audience bursting into applause, to my astonishment, because they'd lived under a materialistic philosophy and they'd seen its problems. As Lenin said, when we've got rid of God, it will be necessary to legalize terror because of what you've all acknowledged, that you're capable of evil. And many people do it. That's a huge problem. Robert Cole, to finish with another anecdote. He teaches the humanities ethics course in the medical school in Harvard. Sent me a couple of books once, which delighted me no end because I would never have gone and talked to him, but he'd read my stuff. And in one of his books, he gives an account of a young woman coming to him after his course. And she says, Dr. Cole, I have a question for you. Lovely man. He said, of course. And she said, well, I come from a fairly humble home in the prairies. I'm a deeply committed Christian. I was delighted to get to Harvard, but I don't really have enough money to live here, so I have to clean rooms to make up the difference. One of the rooms I clean belongs to the young man who came top of your course in ethics. He constantly propositions me when I'm cleaning his room. I've told him I don't appreciate that, yet he continues. How could he come top of your ethics course? Robert Cole said that he had no answer. Of course, when we started ethics in our medical school, I said to our dean at the time, you know, it's very nice to teach the students ethics, but do not think it will make them ethical. What you may get is amateur ethicists who are also doctors, but not ethical doctors. In fact, the guy you've chosen to coordinate this course is a philosopher, and I have lunch with one philosopher regularly, and I know about this man. He's a competent ethicist. He's also an honest man. He says, I only teach ethics, I don't practice them. And a year or two later, he was drummed out of the university when his graduate students at last complained about his habit of persuading him to sleep with them. Them to sleep with him, sorry. A year or two later, having run away from the university, he comes back to look at our course to see whether it's good enough. Isn't there a mismatch there? Don't we need something more? We'll have to pick this up in the next bit. Thank you.
actually have a paper that I'm going to read you, but my preliminary remarks, I'll say some things about what Peter Singer and John Patrick said first. About the last remarks about everyone having some evil in them, that no one is wholly good, although I thought some of you might have raised your hands if he had just asked you, am I mostly good? Nobody dared say raise their hand when they thought it meant, are you wholly good? That would be arrogant, thereby showing you're not wholly good. But that may be true. I don't know the point of it as far as the discussion, if it were about the existence of God, we're not wholly good. And how does it follow that God exists or not? That, I don't understand the inference there. It may be because we're not wholly good and we're weak-willed and so forth, it would be a good thing if there were a God to help us along. It indeed would. There are some things I need. I don't have because I can't afford them, and it would be really good if I had that amount of money or whatever, those abilities that I lack and wish I had so I could play Major League Baseball. But that I need something doesn't mean it exists. It may explain why people believe it exists. It doesn't follow or give you any reason to believe it does. So that argument I don't understand. About Peter Singer, he said he was reflecting on how could it be that humans had special value, all and only humans understood it as a species way. And he suggested, well, what if God created humans and gave each of them an immortal soul? And I'm not convinced that that would even do the trick. I even say to my students in medical ethics, suppose you could either kill an animal or kill a human with an immortal soul. You know what? Given those choices, you should kill the human, because after all, he has an eternal afterlife, and the animal only has this one. So if it came to that, it's not clear to me that having an immortal soul would actually found some kind of special value in humans. These questions that when I read some of the questions, can humans have value, or can humans be valued if there's no God? I originally thought that those questions are too easy to answer. Of course, we can value lots of different things. Some people value collecting rocks or stamps or string. So you could value humans regardless, clearly, whether God exists or not. I think the question is probably whether they would be valuable, that is, worth valuing, if there were no God. And that one seems obvious, the answer to me, too, that for some of the reasons that Peter Singer gave, that humans are special kinds of creatures that have plans and loves and dreams and hopes, and that those things are satisfied as a good thing. And so it's a good thing to respect and value creatures of that sort. Of only that sort? I'm not saying that. There are animals, too, who have, if not plans and so forth, ways of living that bring them joy and satisfaction and the like. And so I think animals are valuable because they have those kinds of lives possible to them, and that's true regardless of whether God exists or not. And I think these questions, I agree completely with Peter Singer. I've written several papers on the problem of evil. I don't think there's an answer to the problem of evil. But I don't think today is actually, at this session anyway, is a question about whether God exists or not. It's a conditional. If God exists, what follows? If God doesn't exist, especially this question, what follows about the value of human life? So really the question about God exists is not on the table, as far as I'm concerned, but I'm glad to talk about it in this discussion. It's a question, if he doesn't exist, what follows? And I think a lot of people think that if he doesn't exist, life would be meaningless, and that's an important implication if it's true. So that's actually what I want to talk about, and that's what my paper's about. People sometimes say that life has no meaning for them because nothing matters anymore. Perhaps they are getting older, and most of their friends and loved ones have died. Their careers are over. The goals they had when they were young, to play Major League Baseball, to become an actor, to write a great novel, to become a famous musician, conductor, or artist, are no longer possibilities for them. Perhaps they have no children, or their children are estranged from them. Why go on living, they ask? Life has no point. It's meaningless. We just as soon be dead, they say. These kinds of thoughts might lead one to conclude that if God does not exist, there is no purpose to life, and so life must be meaningless for everyone without God. Why struggle to get through school, raise a family, pursue a career, build a nice home, if in the end it leads to nothing? There has to be a purpose to life. If there is not, we are all just wasting our time building castles at the seashore that will be washed away when the tide comes in. And not only will our own personal lives, loves, and achievements be lost, so will all of mankind's. Here's how Bertrand Russell puts it in his essay, A Free Man's Worship. If there is no God and no afterlife, then here's the quote, all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of the universe in ruin. But then he adds, all these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy that rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only in the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Some of my students might be surprised. This is Bertrand Russell. You've probably read Principia Mathematica or, I don't know, Inquiry into Reason and Truth. Russell's a poet sometimes, even though he's often a really hard-nosed analytic philosopher. If there's no God, the other Russell, if there is no God, aren't we like Sisyphus, constantly rolling a stone up a hill, only to see it roll down the other side, and then rolling it up that side, only to see it roll down the other side, over and over and over again? Sisyphus leads a meaningless existence because his stone rolling is pointless. Isn't that the way our lives would be if God does not exist? I'm giving the best argument for the theist here, so I'm going to try to answer it. The answer is no. For some of our activities would have a point, even if there's not some ultimate purpose to life, even if there's no afterlife and no God. Suppose I'm one of the doctors in Doctors Without Borders. When disasters strike, I go to them with my colleagues and relieve suffering. My actions have a point and a worthwhile goal. It is to relieve suffering. My life is meaningful and worth living, whether or not God exists. Suppose instead that I'm a mail carrier. I bring mail to people's homes. Sure, I bring junk mail and bills, but I also bring birthday cards and cards of condolence and pictures and gifts, some of which have a great deal of sentimental value. My actions have a point and a worthwhile goal. I am bringing people things they value, and that sometimes touches their hearts. My life is meaningful and worth living, whether or not God exists. Would it be more meaningful and worth living if God exists? Well, note first, this question grants that it can be meaningful and worth living whether or not God exists. Now the question is only whether it could be even better if he did exist. My answer is, it depends. Is there an afterlife if God exists? It does not follow that there is from the mere fact that he exists. But let's suppose there is an afterlife. Still, what is that afterlife like? Is it boring or miserable? If it's not boring, why isn't it? Because we get to do all the interesting things we now do in this life, or because we get to be with those we have loved and admired? If so, then this life could be better without an afterlife. It would be if we did more interesting things, deeply loved, and were loved in return by more people, and so on. Or is afterlife good because, as they say, we will sit at the right hand of God? Okay, still, is that sort of life boring or miserable? If not, why not? It sounds kind of boring to me to be at God's right hand for eternity. Or do I get to talk philosophy with him? Ask him, as Bertrand Russell said he would, why he didn't provide us with more evidence of his existence while we were here on earth. Ask him to explain why he allowed so much terrible suffering of the innocent, and the like. Well, that would be fun, but I don't think it would fill up eternity without becoming boring. I like doing philosophy a lot, but I don't know, for eternity. More life of a certain sort would be good, but it's not clear an eternal life would be. When we think about these things, it seems we should conclude that life can be well worth living if there is no God, because there will be worthwhile ends to pursue even if he does not exist. And it's not so clear that life will be better if he does exist. That depends on whether there will be an afterlife and what that life will be like and how long it will last. As with most questions of value, the existence or non-existence of God is irrelevant. Some things are good, for example, happiness and the relief of suffering, and some things bad, for example, unhappiness and suffering, regardless of whether God exists or not. The same goes for right and wrong. Some things are right, helping those in need, treating people fairly, and some things wrong, genocide, rape, slavery, regardless of whether God exists or not. God's willing that suffering is intrinsically good or genocide is not wrong can't make it so any more than is willing that 2 + 2 = 4 or that bachelors are married can make those things true. Intrinsic value and morality are not based on God's commands, but that does not mean they are baseless. There's a famous moral argument for the existence of God that goes, if God does not exist, then nothing is necessarily right or wrong. Second premise, but some things are necessarily right or wrong. For example, genocide is necessarily wrong. Therefore, God exists. If he doesn't exist, nothing necessarily right or wrong. But hey, there are some things, so God exists. See, theists sometimes think that atheists must deny the second premise, that is, deny that any things are necessarily right or wrong. But of course, they needn't. Lots of us are objectivists about morality, holding that there are necessary objective moral truths on a par with necessary objective mathematical truths. I myself think it's necessarily true that it's wrong to torture an infant to death for the fun of it, that genocide, slavery, and rape are wrong, etc. So I reject the first premise in this moral argument for the existence of God. It says, if God exists, then nothing is necessarily right or wrong. I think those things are necessarily right or wrong, God or not. It's not true that if God does not exist, nothing is necessarily right or wrong. People who think that without God, life must be meaningless and that everything would be morally permissible base their arguments on false premises about what must be so for life to be meaningful and worth living, and what must be so for certain types of actions to be wrong. At first, their arguments might sound good, but they are really unsound. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Russell. At this point, we're going to open it up for short questions. And we'll ask the panelists to provide short answers, so because the panelists will have an opportunity in the next round of speeches to elaborate if they choose to. So we're going to try to stick with a once. There's a microphone here for very short people, or maybe we can make it a little taller if we need to. We'll try to have one sentence question, and we'll ask for a one sentence answer. I'm going to start by asking a question of my colleague, Dr. Russell. You said that you think things are necessarily right or wrong, and that you are a moral objectivist. But because you started out that sentence with "that's what you think," I'm wondering if there is a subjectivity to your moral objectivism, and how would you respond to that?
Mathematics? No, I'm expressing what I believe, and I'm saying that assuming you all believe exactly the same about 2 + 2 = 4. That is, you all think it's subjective, and I think if you think about torturing kids for the fun of it is wrong, you'll think it's just like 2 + 2 = 4.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions? Good, I get to ask the questions. So, Dr. Singer, you indicated that your sense of differentiating between those humans that that do not have, if I may say, a right of survival, whether it's active euthanasia or infanticide or however it's described, between those who do have such a right, in your view, versus those who don't have such a right versus those who do, that is, those who have hopes and plans and an expectation of a future. And I guess my question is it really possible to distinguish? Isn't there a large gray area between a human who has an expectation of hopes and plans for the future and one who does not?
Yes, there is a gray area, and it's sometimes difficult to make those distinctions. But let me just point out that doctors in neonatal intensive care units in every major city in this country and every other country make these decisions every day. They make decisions about when to withdraw respirators from babies with either born extremely prematurely or with other severe conditions. No neonatal intensive care unit that I know treats every such baby with all the resources in its power all the way until that baby dies. And I think to do that would, in fact, be cruel, and that's generally recognized. So, you know, we have to live with uncertainties and gray areas. That's life.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning. Questions for Mike Bonan. Just keep talking. Questions for Dr. Singer. In your practical ethics, you say, when we reject belief in your practical ethics, you say, when we reject belief in God, we must give up the idea that life on this planet has some preordained meaning. Life as a whole has no meaning. Life began in a chance combination, so on and so forth. It seems like this will lead to, if there is no God, there cannot be a moral lawgiver. If there is no moral lawgiver, there can be no absolutes. Do you think that you can reasonably say that a person ought to act morally? If you can say that, how and why should that person act morally when there is no transcendent morality? If you can't reasonably say that a person ought to act morally, what's wrong with speciesism?
Well, since the question was more than one sentence, I'll take more than one answer. I think there was a mistake in the inference, and I think it's exactly the point that Bruce Russell made, in saying there is no lawgiver, I agree with that, to saying there are no moral absolutes. As Bruce Russell argued, I think one can say that torturing a small child for fun is wrong, and that is as objective as basically anything can be. I think that's a defensible position. Philosophically, you could talk about that a lot more. So certainly I think you can say that people ought to do certain things. And for example, people ought not to torture babies for fun. I think you can say that. And so I do think that you can tell people that they ought to do what's right, essentially, because otherwise, you know, all sorts of awful things will happen in the world, including the pointless suffering of babies.
This is for Dr. Singer. I am currently the parent of three children. I'm a caretaker of a small dog, and I was previously the caretaker of a chameleon and some fish. I'm not as good with those, apparently. My question is, if I understood you correctly, you mentioned you sort of drew the line of value, for lack of a better term, at vertebrates. And between the vertebrates that I've had in my care, I've noticed great variance in their abilities for joy, hope, plans, and some of the other things that you said were of value. My dog seems to have some sort of joy when we relate positively, but I don't see any plans. I see a routine. And with the other vertebrates, the chameleons and the fish, I didn't see any at all. So why do you draw the line at vertebrates for value, if I understood you correctly, or would you draw it somewhere else?
I don't actually draw the line at vertebrates. I simply wanted to make things simple because I'm not discussing today which animals are morally significant. I think here, too, there's a gray area somewhere between the oyster and maybe the octopus, which I do think is sentient, although it's an invertebrate. So I don't actually draw any real line at vertebrates. And I agree, in fact, with pretty much everything you said. That is that, you know, it does seem clear that dogs can enjoy their life, and it's not clear to us that a chameleon or a fish can. I don't really know whether they can, but But I am pretty convinced that fish can feel pain, for example, and I would bet that the chameleon can too, although I've seen studies about pain in fish. I happen not to have seen any about studies in chameleons. So, you know, the point is, I think, that different beings have different interests, and this is true among humans as well. So we need to treat them all as individuals, but not draw a sharp line at any particular species boundary.
Dr. Russell and Dr. Singer, I have a question for you. I worked hard to make this one interrogative sentence. So in the rather sparse ontology of naturalism, what's the grounding? I'm still confused by the grounding for this deep sense of value that we project on humans, that we say humans have, and what's our epistemic access to this?
That sounds like a Dr. Russell question.
So I think that you might ask a comparable question about mathematics. What is its grounding? Do you have to have God for the mathematical truths to be true? My answer is no. And the question then would be, what's your epistemic access to mathematics? And my answer is reason, that you have certain rational insights about mathematical claims or moral ones, and you also have certain rational insight about what follows from what, whether it's in mathematics or in morality. And so I treat morality just like mathematics.
Thank you. I'm going to interfere just for a second and ask Dr. Patrick a question.
I'm very happy listening.
and that is, in speaking of logic, and get it right down to zero or one, is the law of non-contradiction, is that required by God? In other words, can there be a law of non-contradiction without God?
I've never asked him, of course. it seems to me that the world has that in it. It's the way the world is, and that is sufficient. I couldn't do science if there wasn't a law of non-contradiction. And these things are clearly universal. Now, Christians call that the image of God within us. Secularists don't. We have different names for a similar phenomenon. I don't think that's where our real differences show up most clearly, but we'll come to that later, probably.
Dr. Singer, what I got from your argument was that ability to suffer and ability to experience pleasure equal worth, and I agree with that, but I cannot come up with any logical reasoning for that. So why does the ability to suffer, why is that equal worth for a person? Why should one care that somebody else is suffering or somebody else is experiencing pleasure? Why does that imply worth?
Well, if a being can suffer or experience pleasure, then it matters what we do to that being. It has interests. If it doesn't have those capacities, I don't think it has interests. Now, why does it matter? The short answer to that is it matters to me if I suffer or if I don't get joy or pleasure that I could get. And I am of no greater significance, and this is not a claim that needs anything to say anything about God, just, you know, in the world, my interests are no greater significance than those of someone else with similar interests. So it's the same significance. It's, if you like, the universalizing of the significance that I give to myself and the absence of any good reason why I shouldn't give the same significance to others.
Dr. Singer, I think I understood you a while ago to say there are no moral absolutes.
No, you didn't understand me say there's no moral absolutes.
Okay.
I said the contrary.
You said the contrary?
I said the contrary in response to the gentleman over there who asked, said there's no lawgiver, therefore there's no absolutes. I said that was the fallacy in what he was arguing, that it doesn't follow from the fact that there's no lawgiver that there are no moral absolutes. And I agreed with Professor Russell that, for example, torturing a baby for fun is absolutely wrong.
Okay, but you do hold moral absolutes in some way.
Yes, I do.
Okay, all right.
Since his question was quick and simple, I'll give you two and cheat. First, Dr. Russell, you presented this argument with two premises, that if God doesn't exist, then there is no good or evil, that some would argue that there clearly is evil, therefore God exists. And went on to kind of make the argument that theists would argue somehow that that atheists or those who don't believe in God don't therefore believe in evil. But I would argue the opposite, that the point is that theists do believe that there is evil in the world, and that atheists know there's evil in the world. And so the question would be, on what basis, what grounding do you have to define evil or good? At the end of the day, if there is no transcendent being, isn't it all subjective? There can't be any absolute, then, grounding for defining good or evil. And then finally, for you, Dr. Singer, if being human is a person possessing a certain set of characteristics, who determines these characteristics that a person has to possess in order for them to be called human? Where is this list kept? Who's decided this? Or isn't that also totally arbitrary?
And we'll take one more question. Hopefully it'll be a one-sentence question.
So you don't quite have my argument right. It doesn't go, if God doesn't exist, there's no evil, but there is. It goes, if God doesn't exist, it's not necessary. There's nothing that is necessarily right or wrong or good or bad. And the second premise says, but there are some things that are necessarily right or wrong, good or bad. And so I said, you know what? I accept that there are some things that are necessarily right or wrong. Torturing kids for the fun of it is necessarily, in every possible world, wrong. And hence, I accepted the second premise, and I just said it doesn't follow. If God doesn't exist, there's nothing which is necessarily right or wrong. Here's some examples. Torturing kids for the fun of it is necessarily wrong, regardless of whether God exists. To him, I was going to say, if I had a chance, suffering is intrinsically bad as a necessary truth. It's intrinsically bad. It sometimes can be instrumentally good. By suffering, we can develop other character traits, courage, perseverance, and the like. But I think it's just obvious that suffering is intrinsically bad is true in every possible world. The foundations, Peter keeps helping me in saying, I don't think that because there's no lawgiver, there's no law. I said, just because it's not based in God doesn't mean it's baseless.
So what's the basis?
What's the basis of mathematics, would you say?
Well, I'm asking the question. I understand that you're saying that if there is no God, that you're rejecting the premise that there has to be a God in order to have a basis. Then what's the alternative?
I was arguing by analogy. I thought you would accept that mathematics doesn't need God to have a base. And so I was saying, why couldn't moral truths, fundamental moral truths, be like the fundamental truths of mathematics? Do you reject that mathematics has to have God to have a base?
I guess what I reject is that you're not giving an alternative for the basis. If there is no God, you're not giving an alternative for the basis of evil. You say it's intrinsic.
Not the evil. Existence of evil.
If I can say something just to what you, because you did address a question to me. You said something like, well, where are these standards kept or whatever for how we sort which humans are valuable or not? Right, but let me just say, there seems to be, and it goes right back to many comments that have been made, there seems to be this false assumption, I think, that somehow if we believe in God, then everything is clear and we know what to do and we have this list, and if we don't, we don't. But, look at all the different religions in the world. They all have these different standards, these different lists. Whether we're theists or atheists, we have to make up our mind and use our thought and intelligence to try and work out what we ought to do. It's clear that, you can have faith and think that what you ought to do is get into an airplane and fly it into the World Trade Center. Having faith doesn't mean that faith in God doesn't mean that you do the right thing. So we're going to have to use our thought and intelligence to decide this question anyway.
My question is for Dr. Patrick. Are you aware of any statistics that would compare how much percentage of time that an atheist, for example, would give to help the suffering versus those non-atheists, those with a religious background, and their amount of time, money, et cetera, to help the suffering?
That's just beginning to happen. There's a guy called Seal in London who's beginning to study the behavior of doctors in relation to their belief. His initial conclusions so far are that you need to know what your doctor believes, because doctors who have no belief in God are in fact slightly more likely to shorten your life, which is to be expected. You can go a lot further back, of course, because the turning point in medicine, in my view, was in fact Hippocrates, and he understood that in those days, doctors killed for profit. They are doing it again, and soon it's legal in some places to do it. Now, when I'm in Africa, every now and again, I meet the witch doctor. Now, when he comes into the village, it's very clear that he's not your local friendly pediatrician. People are afraid of him, and for good reason. He can cure some things. There's some good herbal remedies that he will use. He's an even better toxicologist. So you must always worry when you go to the witch doctor whether somebody else has paid more for your death than you've paid for your life. And of course, rationally, there's no reason why you shouldn't take both fees, since you won't be alive to complain. That, Hippocrates thought, was not conducive to trusting your doctor. And he was right. And I therefore see in a secular society that euthanasia will and probably should be legalized at some point, just like abortion. But we should have said there ought to be a group of doctors who are necessarily, because of respect for the people who hold the alternative view, or over 50% of the population, are forbidden to do either abortion or euthanasia. I could teach both these gentlemen to kill somebody in a few hours. And I seriously think that lawyers and philosophers should be in charge of doing the euthanizing. It's no part of a doctor's job to kill someone.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You'd accept that, wouldn't you?
We'll have that discussion later. No, I wouldn't accept the last one.
Yeah.
Thank you for the questions. We're now going to go through another round. We'll hear first from Dr. Springer, and then we'll hear from Dr. Russell, and then lastly from Dr. Patrick. So we'll go right in the order of the way they're seated there. And we'll also have a few minutes at the end for a couple of final questions. So, each one will take about 12 to 13 minutes or so. And because it is a little bit like when I earned my black belt in martial arts, I had to fight two people at once in order to prove that I had what it took to be a black belt. Dr. Patrick, we're going to give you a couple extra minutes at the end so you can earn your black belt. So we'll start with Dr. Springer, please.
Okay, thank you. I think we've already had a very interesting discussion, and I'm sure that's going to continue in the other sessions. I'm not sure how many of you will be able to follow to the other sessions, but we've certainly had a lot of interesting questions and issues raised. And I think, you know, there are some fundamental philosophical questions that are underlying some of this discussion, of which probably the ones that came up in questions there about is morality objective, and if so, on what basis can it be objective, is one of the most important philosophical issues. Now, it's a difficult issue to address in even 10 minutes, let alone a single sentence. I hope we get time to say a little bit more about it. Certainly, among my philosopher colleagues, the view that Professor Russell and I basically have been agreeing on is not universally accepted. There certainly are philosophers who think that there can be no objective morality, that we have to settle for something less. We can still have, you know, we can make moral judgments and encourage others to share our moral views, but ultimately there isn't an objective basis for it. On the other hand, there is also a considerable body of philosophical thought, which includes atheists and secularists as well as religious people, that thinks that there is objective truth in morality. That it does not require God. And now, whereas people have been saying, well, what's the basis for that? I think the question can also go the other way. That is, suppose you do believe in God, what do you think is the basis for morality? Now, a lot of people say then, well, of course, since I'm a theist, God is the basis for morality. But there is a philosophical question that can be asked about that, which is a very ancient one, goes back, in fact, to ancient Greece when Plato wrote a dialogue called the Euthyphro, in which a character, Plato's dialogues, for those who are not familiar with them, tend to have the major character as Socrates. We don't always know to what extent this corresponds to the historical Socrates, but Socrates is reported as getting into a dialogue or discussion about a philosophical question with someone else. And in the Euthyphro, this character is called Euthyphro. And Euthyphro tries to define goodness, or it's usually translated, the Greek term is piety, but anyway, I think goodness is close enough, as what pleases the gods, right? And again, let's translate to our time, and let's say what God approves of is something like what Euthyphro is saying goodness is. And Socrates then comes back and says, well, do the gods approve of certain things because they're good, or are they good because God approves of them? And if you think about that question, for the theist who wants to say you need God to have objectivity in ethics, there's a problem either way. Because if you say it's only good because God approves them, that suggests that if God actually approved of torturing small babies for fun, that would be good. And if God disapproved of what Dr. Patrick has been doing, for instance, helping undernourished babies in Jamaica to get enough to eat and get a decent diet so they can grow, if God hated anyone doing that, Dr. Patrick would have been doing something wrong on this view in helping those babies to thrive. Now, that's not a view that I could accept. I can't accept that whether those things are right or wrong is so arbitrary that they depend on whether God approved it or not. But if you say, well, God couldn't have approved of torturing a baby for fun because that's just wrong and God is good and he wouldn't approve of something like that, then you've accepted that that's wrong independently of God's will. So that view is not going to help you. That view is conceding what Professor Russell and I have been saying, that there are independent standards of what's right or wrong independently of what God approves. So I think the assumption that some of you seem to be making, that all we need to know to do is believe in God, and then we have an objective basis for ethics, is one that doesn't really work. The other point I want to make again is one that I made briefly in response to another question, and that is that we also can't really rely on belief in God for our knowledge of what's right or wrong. Right? Even if you say, okay, well, God, well, there is objective good or bad, but I wouldn't know what it is apart from belief in God, apart from, let's say, belief in particular God and the scriptures, many Christians and Jews would say, that also doesn't seem to work because we're extremely selective in what we take from the Bible. There's this, you can find it on the web, there's this very amusing letter to Dr. Laura, Laura Schlesinger, I think she's just ceased to be a commentator, but because she has said, look, I know homosexuality is wrong because it says it in the Bible. So somebody writes her a letter in which he says, I'm very pleased that you've settled the question of homosexuality. We know that, for instance, but there's many other questions I like to have settled. For example, it says in the Bible that we can have slaves not of our own nation, but of our neighboring nations. My friend says that this means we can enslave Mexicans, but not Canadians. Is that correct? Well, you're pretty close to Canada here, so I guess you have a specific interest in that topic. And it says, for example, that if my neighbor works on the Sabbath, it says in the Bible, I must put him to death. Is that correct? And so on. There are, it also says a lot of other things. It says, for example, homosexuality is an abomination. True. It also says that eating shellfish is an abomination. Are they equally abominable, you might say? Well, so you have to use your thought and your intelligence, whether you're religious, whether you take the Bible as the source of morality or not. You can't get away from that. And that's why I think the idea that somehow it all becomes straightforward and easy if you're a theist or a believing Christian, but if you're an atheist or a secularist, everything somehow turns into flux and there's no bedrock and no certainty, I think that's a mistake that we should not continue to hold. How am I going on time? Okay. So let me just then conclude by saying a little... 4 minutes. Okay. Oh, excellent. Good. Doing well here. I want to return a little bit then to that key question that we have talking about here about valuing humans. And as I say, I think we need to really think about what we do in a lot of areas to look at what we really think about valuing humans. We should not just accept this sort of rhetoric that we say that every human life is sacrosanct, because there's various ways in which I think we depart from that. One of them I've already mentioned. We make decisions about withdrawing life support in intensive care units, and we do it on the basis of quality of life, not sanctity of life. Now, practices will vary a little bit in hospitals. In some neonatal intensive care units, the doctors will discuss a lot with the parents. In others, less. I think, fortunately, there's been more of a tendency to involve the parents in these decisions. And I agree with that. I think parents are the ones most affected by life and death decisions. If you have a child with severe disabilities or is going to have severe disabilities, it's going to dramatically affect the parents and the family. We'll be talking about that, I know, more in one of the later sessions. But I think you have to have that discussion. You can't just say, well, it's a human being, so we must do everything we can. So we have some gray areas there about making difficult decisions. And I don't think it makes a huge difference whether you bring about the death of an infant by withdrawing life support or by taking active steps to end that baby's life. That's another question we can talk about more later, but we are doing it. Then, as I said before, the other side of this is, what are we really prepared to do to save lives, where parents want their children to live, where the children are old enough themselves to want to live? Nevertheless, there's a lot that we can do that we don't do. There's a lot of medical programs around the world trying to immunize children against simple diseases like measles, trying to provide safe drinking water so children don't get diarrhea, trying to provide oral rehydration therapy available in villages so that when children do get diarrhea, they don't have to die from it, providing bed nets to protect against malaria. All of these areas need more resources. And yet we have such a lot in this country that most of us are not sharing to any significant amount with those organizations that are doing effective grassroots work to save lives. So again, I think it's another way of saying we, whether or not we believe in God, are not valuing human life as much as we should be. Thank you.
Is that yours, Peter?
So just to start, Peter and I didn't talk before this, I want to you to know, but he was defending this view that God can't make things right or wrong or good or bad by his commands or will. That's something I said near the end of that first little talk I gave today, saying he couldn't make happiness or fairness, he couldn't make happiness bad and intrinsically bad or suffering intrinsically good just by willing it, or he couldn't make genocide and rape and slavery right just by willing them. That's too arbitrary. You can't just make things turn into right just because you will that they be so. But if you hold the divine command theory of ethics, that's an implication. The other thing is about, I do like this distinction between questions about the objectivity of morality. It's sometimes philosophers say that's a metaphysical question. What's the nature of morality? What's its basis? That's one question I was saying. Well, it doesn't need a lawgiver to have a base. Neither does mathematics, and I drew the analogy between the two. And the other question is epistemological, a question about knowledge or justification. Peter's point was, even if morality did depend on God's will, there'd be a question, well, how do you know what his will is? So there'd be this epistemological question regardless. And what would you do except use your reason to figure out, well, an all-good God wouldn't command torturing kids for the fun of it, would he? Because that's completely unreasonable, and he's a reasonable being, and so he wouldn't do that. So actually, when it comes to epistemology, you're going to have to appeal to reason to answer questions what's right and wrong, what's intrinsically good and bad, even if metaphysically the foundation of morality rests on some kind of divine commands. But of course that view has, I think, absurd consequences, but even if you swallowed it, you'd have this other problem. How do you know what God commands? I want to address a question that came up, this second part when I get to talk, a question that came up about what reason do you have to be moral, even if we decide it doesn't matter whether God's commands are the foundation of morality or it's independent like I think. Let's suppose that there are certain things that are right or wrong, whatever the basis happens to be. The question is, well, do you always have sufficient reason to do those things? And especially if God doesn't exist, the worry is on some occasions you might not have sufficient reason to do what's right. You would have sufficient reason to do what's wrong. So that's the topic I want to address in this brief part of my presentation. Why be moral is an old question that philosophers have been addressing at least since Plato's Republic. That dialogue contains a story about a shepherd named Gyges who discovered a ring that allowed its wearer to become invisible when he turned the flat side toward his palm. That enabled anyone who wore it to get away with lots of bad things. He could rob and kill people without fear of detection. So why shouldn't he do those things if it's in his self-interest? Let's grant that it would be morally wrong of him to steal and kill. Still, why isn't it at least rationally permissible, maybe even rationally required, for him to perform the wrongful actions that he knows he can get away with? The theist has an answer. He can't get away with acting wrongly. God is omniscient, which means that he knows everything it is possible to know. So he will know what a wrongdoer has done, even if no human being does, and so even if the wrongdoer gets away with it when it comes to humans. God is like Santa Claus. He's always making a list, checking it twice, gonna find out who's naughty and nice. No ring of Gyges is going to prevent God from finding out if you've done wrong, and when he finds out, you are going to pay. If God exists, you are always rationally required to do what's right because so acting is in your long-term self-interest. However, if God does not exist, it can be in your rational self-interest to do wrong, say to cheat on your taxes or your tests. To have your mistress bumped off, as in the film Crimes and Misdemeanors, to steal a car or some cash, or to make off like Madoff with other people's money in a pyramid scheme. In fact, an argument for God's existence can be constructed that appeals to these ideas. I'm making it as hard as possible on the atheist, but then I want to answer. Necessarily, this argument says, premise one, it's never irrational to do what's right. That is, you're always rationally permitted to do what's right. But if God does not exist, it can be irrational to do what's right. You can be rationally required to do what's wrong. And so it follows from these premises, therefore God does exist. Why think that it can never be irrational to do what's right? Why is it always rationally permissible to do the right thing? Well, imagine someone who makes a genuine sacrifice to care for his aged mother or his autistic or Down syndrome child. Suppose he has to give up pursuit of a career he has always wanted. Suppose he has to move away from other loved ones to care for this one person. It does not seem irrational of him to make such a huge sacrifice. You're never a fool for doing what's right. You might be a fool for making a huge sacrifice to gain fame or to drive a nice car and wear nice clothes, but you're never a fool for making a huge sacrifice to do what's right. Even if doing that will cost you your life and your death will be agonizing because it will burn you at the stake or draw and quarter you, it is rationally permissible, even if not rationally required, for you to make those sacrifices. There's a lot of plausibility in the first premise in this argument that says it can never be irrational to do what's right. What about the second premise? That one says if God does not exist, then it can be irrational to do what's right. Well, I think this is true. Well, this premise presupposes that rationality is either a function of what you desire or what's in your self-interest. these are not equivalent because I might desire what is not in my self-interest, say desire to smoke, when I know that it isn't good for me. So let's take one proposal at a time, desire theory, self-interest theory. Let's first assume that rationality is a function of your desires, or better, of what you would desire if you were fully informed of the relevant facts, weren't emotionally upset, were thinking clearly, and the like. In short, let's assume that what is rational is what you would desire if you were ideally situated. If that were true, then when ideally situated, I might most desire to cheat on my taxes or my test, to have my mistress bumped off, to steal a car or cash, etc. In short, I might most desire to do those things that are wrong. According to the theory of rationality we're considering, then I would be rationally required to do what is wrong if I had good reason to believe I could get away with it. If God does not exist, then I could have a good reason to believe I would get away with wrongdoing, and thereby what I most desire to do when ideally situated. I'm making this case, you can see that on a certain theory of rationality and no God, it might be rational to do wrong. So according to the theory of rationality we are considering, if God does not exist, I could be rationally required to do what is wrong. That is just what the second premise in the argument says. A parallel argument for that premise can be constructed if we assume a self-interest conception of rationality. If God does not exist, it could be in my self-interest to do wrong, but then according to the self-interest theory of rationality, I could be rationally required to do what's wrong, rationally prohibited from doing what's right. In other words, if God does not exist, it could be irrational for me to do what is right, which is just what the second premise in this argument for God says. So it looks as though there are pretty good arguments for both premises in this big argument, since the conclusion is entailed by those premises, that is, follows necessarily from them, it looks like there's a pretty good argument to show that God exists. I was supposed to be the atheist. I've just given you, I think, a really strong argument for the existence of God. Here's what I say. I think where this argument goes wrong is in implicitly assuming a desire-based or self-interest theory of rationality. Is it necessarily true that if I desire something when I'm ideally situated, that is, well-informed, not emotionally upset, thinking clearly, etc., then it's rational for me to desire that thing? In an as yet to be published book called On What Matters, Derek Parfit, a contemporary British philosopher, argues that it's not. He argues on this ideal desire-based theory, it could be rational to desire agony for yourself, for its own sake, because you might desire that even when you're ideally situated. In the past, I've said to my students that when ideally situated, you might desire to die at 50 just because you turned 50. Neither of these desires is rational, though according to the ideal desire theory, they are. So much the worse for that theory. If that theory of rationality is false, we cannot appeal to it in an argument to show that if God does not exist, you could be rationally required to do what's wrong. Let's turn to the self-interest theory of rationality. Is it true that you're always rationally required to act in your self-interest? I don't think so. Think of the examples of self-sacrifice to care for an aged mother or an autistic or Down syndrome child. Doing that may not be in your self-interest, but you're not rationally required not to take care of them. So even if wrongdoing is in your self-interest, it does not follow that you're rationally required to do wrong because it is in your self-interest. We've just seen that being in your self-interest is not sufficient for being rationally required to do something. Doing the right thing may always be rationally permitted, but we have not yet found an argument that says if God does not exist, you can be rationally required to do what's wrong. The arguments we have considered to that conclusion rest on theories of rationality that have been shown to be false. One last word on behalf of the theist. We have not found a good argument to show that if God does not exist, then you could be rationally required to do what's wrong. However, that does not mean that that statement is false. That's true. But without a good argument in its favor, we should suspend judgment about its truth. But if we do that, we will not be justified in believing the conclusion that says that God does exist. If you have some premise, it may be true, but you don't have any reason to believe it. You don't have any reason to believe it's false. You better suspend judgment. If you suspend judgment on the crucial premise, you can't get to the conclusion. That's because to be justified in believing the conclusion of an argument, you must be justified in believing its premises, and that the premises support the conclusion. So far, we have found no justification for believing that if God does not exist, then you could be rationally required to do what's wrong. And isn't the fact that some action is morally required, that is obligatory, a strong reason in favor of doing it? Perhaps it's so strong that no other sorts of reasons could ever outweigh that reason. Then no wonder it's always rationally permissible to do what's morally required. We don't need God to ensure that acting morally is rationally permitted. By their very nature, moral requirements provide enough reason that no amount of self-interest or desire-based reasons could make violating these requirements rationally required. It seemed otherwise only because we covertly assumed a mistaken theory of reasons for action. We don't need God to ensure that doing the right thing is at least rationally permissible. Morality on its own is reason enough to ensure that it is.
Dr. Patrick.
I would never have thought that it would turn out quite the way it has, and I'm delighted that it has so far. Obviously, you can do good without believing in God. That's a no-brainer. It was merely a start. The question seems to me to be much more important, is how do we care for one another and what makes that possible and what facilitates it most extensively? Not many people are as committed to being entirely post-indoctrinement rationalists as these two are, and they can make it work. But for most of the rest of us, we need help, and Christianity is often maligned in this area, so I want to use my time at the moment to put a more positive spin than they probably thought about in this respect. I accept entirely there are truthful statements to be made about things and false statements to be made about everything. Whether you can know them or not is another question. The same applies to just actions and unjust, to honor and dishonor, to love and hatred, to fidelity and infidelity. Those are all such big ideas that we have great difficulty handling them on a day-to-day basis. And we certainly don't analyze them. You couldn't do medicine if you had to start from that position every time. What we do, I think, is we inhabit a cultural story that makes sense of it for us. And those cultural stories change over time. I think this is what McIntyre means when he talks about the fact that we are rationalists, but we are dependent rationalists. None of us can live independent of the way we were brought up, the stories that informed us, etc., etc. So that the discussion of particular situations will vary depending upon that previous environmental situation in which you lived. And becoming a Christian doesn't get rid of that environmental background immediately. That's a long-term process. These gentlemen live in universities which were founded by Christians in around the 12th century and have been deeply influenced by the whole of that history. And they acknowledge, and I'm sure they're deeply respectful of, say, Alvin Plantinga and Alistair MacIntyre. And they go back, and I've heard Peter Singer quote Thomas Aquinas to disagree with him on some points, for I'm sure he agrees with him on many others. That's our history, and it's one to be proud of. Now, I didn't really think about this in a very vigorous way until one day I was confronted with it absolutely in your face. I saw a little girl, and she had a septic knee that had been neglected. By the time she got to me, she was septicemic, she had pus in the tibia and the femur, and she was dying. Now, the only thing we could do at that point to save her life was to cut off her leg quickly and then fill her with what antibiotics we had. Obviously, the next thing was to talk to her parents and say that this is what needed to be done. And they said, well, we need to think about that. And I said, you've got 20 minutes. The OR will be ready then, and we need to move fast if we're going to save her life. To my utter horror and astonishment, 15 minutes later, those parents picked up the little girl and went home. Now, I had finished pediatric ward rounds earlier that morning, so I had a little time. The surgeon who would have done the operation was busy. He went to his next patient. So I said to the nurses, may I talk to you? Because I'm upset and obviously you're not. And they said, of course you may. Providentially, I asked the right question. I said, what would those parents have done if this had been a little boy? And they said, oh, they would have done the amputation. I said, why would you treat little boys and little girls differently? And they said, in our culture, it is a woman's job to till the fields, fetch the water, cook the food, and bear the children. A woman with one leg cannot do those things, so she will have a life not worth living. Now, of course, if you're a multiculturalist, you must accept that view, if you're a radical multiculturalist, you must accept that view as just as valid as the one which I hope you have. I was horrified. But I saw that that was where they were in their culture at the time. Now, these people have things to teach us. They will not believe that we in Canada and the US have working poor people who have inadequate housing. They say, surely a rich nation like yours can help one another build some decent houses. If you grow too old in an African village to rethatch your roof, which has to be done every year, it will be done for you. That's their duty. Interestingly enough, they had no word for trust in the way that we use it, but that's another story. They had the idea of culturally required behavior. We all inhabit cultural stories, as is changing quite rapidly at the moment. And as Lee Harris described very beautifully in what I thought was an elegant paper, and I hope to talk to Peter Singer about it later to see what his destructive comments are, but he says it is in the nature of people like these gentlemen, who are brilliant with words and brilliant with arguments and rhetorically competent as well. Dawkins is rhetorically competent, but I'm sure many of them wish he shut up occasionally because he's not so philosophically competent as they are. But the trouble is they can make people like you and me feel stupid when they've no right to do that. They have frequently, in the history of the world, been responsible for attacking gut responses which were deeply held and which led to a stable society, and they've led to unstable societies. A society can only be held together by what it has in common. You can't build a society on difference. So what I hope will come out of this day is some discussion of how we are going to live together when we have incommensurable commitments. How do we live together in charity and not get into a civil war, which we could easily do at some point? There are certainly hotheads on both sides who are prepared to instigate violence. I don't want that. But a society has to be built on what we hold in common, and what we hold in common is diminishing. This is McIntyre's point in After Virtue, that we no longer have a moral consensus. And that, historically, has always been bad news for a society. It's usually step one, if you believe Toynbee, in the society falling apart. But what I want to do in the last few minutes is to use this opportunity to point out why, as a more weak mortal than they are, I find that my belief in God is not necessary to understand what goodness is, but it is surely a huge help in doing it. This, I find, very helpful with students. Students come and thank me time and time again when I take them through this sequence, which I'm going to abuse my position for at the moment, just to take you through, so that you have some sense that we're not just dogmatic enforcers of a particular set of rules as we understand them. We can be, you know, a little bit more nuanced than that. Every one of you in this room wants to be happy, to avoid suffering as far as possible. All of us are in that category. The problem is that our world at the moment has lost its bearings, in my view, on what happiness is and how it is achieved. I want to leave you with a four-level way of beginning to think about it, which obviously is also designed to make theism more attractive. Level one happiness, I call animal happiness. It's basically what we share with the animals. Now, I live on a farm and raise cattle. They're all grass-fed. There's been no antibiotic or insecticide on that farm for 10 years. They're very nice animals. I like looking at them. They do me no harm. Even my grandchildren can walk amongst them. They could push over any fence that I could build, but they don't. As long as they have food, water, and an occasional, very occasional bull, there is no problem. They will behave very lawfully, chewing the cud, and only complaining if I don't come out with some treats occasionally. They do need a salt lick as well. Sex they have in public without any embarrassment. We're different, so far. But there are no eating disorders in cows, and there are no sexual behavior disorders in cows until we come on the scene. We can feed cows in a way that will lead to an eating disorder and allow them to kill themselves. And the way we get beat for market, I don't, but the way it is done, I consider to be unethical, but that's another issue. But if you abuse the good of food, which is meant to be a social activity contained within conversation and the family dining room table, it will shortly become an unhappiness. I've spent too many hours of my life talking to young people with anorexia nervosa, mainly women, bulimia, and other problems along those orders. That's when you abuse the good of food for something for which it is not appropriate. Sex is even worse, and we're doing this too. If you have sex disconjoined from committed love, it will shortly become first boring and then perverted. Now, there are exceptions, but as a general statement, that is true. And we see a lot of it, and its consequences are not good. One of the really huge changes in my lifetime has been that when I entered medical school to be capable of getting through finals and the bit on sexually transmitted disease, I needed 4 diseases. Students now need 40. That is not progress, or at least not progress in the direction that I hope any of us would wish to go. The only way out now is to go up a level and go and take some courses from people like Peter Singer and Bruce. Learn to train your mind, as Socrates wanted you to know how to live the good life. But how many of you students wake up in the morning, even in Wayne State, and say, good, another day at school. By the end of this day, I will have a better structure for my life. I'll be a happier person. Has that thought ever occurred to you? It's not what's happening, is it? In fact, in medical school, we stupidly take people into medical school, and we know we're not going to throw them out unless they have complete meltdown, because we no longer know how to measure moral turpitude, so they're no longer thrown out for that. The only way you can get thrown out is by having a mental breakdown. And what do we do to you? We arrive at medical school and we start ramming information into your head that is at a rate that is faster than can be assimilated. And then we induce neurosis by doing information recall examinations. That is utterly stupid. I mean, once you're in medical school, you need an apprenticeship-based program. And when you've acquired the competencies, you get your degree. And there should be no neurosis attack. But within weeks of being in medical school, we know that 20 to 30% of you are alcohol or drug addicted, and you have major problems. And that goes on throughout the life of doctors. People running emergency response programs have to assume that no more than 30% of doctors will be competent when called off duty, because drugs or alcohol will interfere with that. That used not to be so. We're not doing well. The only way now is to go up another level and begin to realize that the goods that you can recognize rationally, when you do them, help. The best thing I ever did with medical students, they asked for it, they wanted it. The first time I went to Africa for a year, when I got back, I had to give a slideshow, of course, and then the class feminist and the leader of the students for choice came and said, will you take us to Africa with you? I said, I don't think I'm going back again. They said, your wife is. And they were right, and so I was. And I said, what would you do for me? And they said, anything you want. So I developed what I laughingly call my medical student abuse program. I taught them the theory of treating a malnourished child in Canada. These were preclinical students. Then we went to Africa, and they did half of one ward round in the pediatric ward before they turned green and walked out. I mean, the ward round, the hospital I know well, one ward round, you see all the infections in the book that you'd ever heard of and many that you hadn't. The only one that's not there is sleeping sickness, fortunately. And then I showed them a real malnourished child. And then the next day, we walked for 1 to 2 days into the bush. And I left them in a village where I'd arranged with the headman that they should stay for 5 weeks. And they were to do a health survey of the village and find and resuscitate 2 malnourished children. No running water, no electricity, hole in the ground for a toilet, a mud hut for a house. Now, I was looking for idealists, so they were largely not Christian. Christians at university are usually in revolt against their background. I prefer to leave them alone until they've got over it. But a few of them were Christian. That was a stunningly effective story. They went to help, which is very good. They actually received far more than they gave. And they recognized it. They also got rid of some of their prejudices routinely. I never said a word about it, but they would say to me, we can recognize the Christian families from the pagan families without asking. Do you know, only Christians plant flowers. You can think about that. And certainly fruit trees. But of course, you can do medicine in the same way. People go into medicine, they arrive idealists, and we turn them into cynics in 4 years. And then they go into recovery. But patients teach you more than anyone else ever will. And as you get sucked into their lives, you get paid in currency that's much better than dollars. Especially the last clinic I ran for the severely disabled children, at the end of that afternoon, I was usually in doubt as to who the patient was. But all this is need to be needed. There's still more. And what I want is for you to have the more. You will come to a stage in your life, these gentlemen will come to a stage in their life when their bodies begin to decay. Hopefully they die before they get Alzheimer's, because it would be a terrible way for a professor to go. But it may be the way they go, I don't know. But we're all going to go that way. Naked we came and naked we leave. So if your happiness is rooted in what you can do, you're going to map into unhappiness at that point. It's not necessary. There's another way, another step. Now, I'm just going to tell you 2 happiness 4 stories. And you're smart. You can connect the dots. The first one is not mine. It's from a friend at Yale, Diane Comp, who was professor of pediatric oncology for many years. She's just retired. She's now in Liberia, still doing pediatrics. She won't last long because she's overweight and diabetic, but it's a good way to go. She'll get malaria and won't cope, I'm rather afraid, but she's doing good things. But like me, she grew up in a home that was rooted in transcendence, went to university and cast it, well, not cast it on one side, but ceased allowing it to have any role in life. If you come from such a home, you have built into you that dependency McIntyre is talking about that leads you to be, I suspect these gentlemen have homes of that sort. The things that your parents give you, the way you live, your mother looking over your shoulder when you're about to do something you ought not to. You know, I hope you know what I'm talking about. Diane was like that. She was also smart. You get promoted. She's running a pediatric oncology program at Yale. And she's become an existentialist. She believes that life is ultimately without meaning. She did everything for those kids. She's a single woman. She loves kids. She knows all their names. But what can an existentialist say to a dying child? Only, this is absurd. I'm glad it's you and not me. But that's neither nice nor kind. So she solved the problem by never being there. Her mother, however, did turn up at the back of her head and say, Diana, I didn't bring you up to behave like this. Of course, in the end, you give in to your conscience. The first child she sat with was a little girl of 8 who was dying of leukemia. Diane had failed. She's sitting by the bed with the parents as this little child entered her terminal coma. But children, every now and again, just before they die, will have a lucid interval. And this child had it. Suddenly, she sat up in bed and said, Mummy, can you see the angels? Can you hear their singing? It's beautiful. And she fell back dead. Now, if you were the parent, apart from weeping, what would you do? Of course, it was a great comfort. It was a great help. All I'm pointing out is there is more. And to deny these things, I could go on for the next hours telling you these stories. And the more dangerous the situation you're in, the more you learn about it. It can deal with anxiety. You can stand in front of a man with a loaded Kalashnikov and not be afraid, which is stunning. That happened to us. My wife, myself, and my son in Central Africa. The car had broken down during the day. We were driving after dark, which in eastern Zaire is an extremely dangerous thing to do because Mobutu tells his troops to live off the land. That was in the 80s. It's now the non-democratic Democratic Republic of Congo, and it's even worse. But we were stopped just before midnight by a drunken soldier with a Kalashnikov. And he made us get out of the vehicle. And the week before, two people had been killed on that road and robbed, but undoubtedly by a soldier. Nothing had happened. Our driver also was there, and a couple of Africans. Now, he made his first mistake. He didn't kill us immediately. I've got to stop, but you'll let me finish this 2 minutes less. After a minute or two, I said to my son, who was 19 at the time, "Are you afraid?" And he said, "I'm not. Isn't that strange?" I said, "Neither am I, and neither is your mother." And he knows that, and it's bothering him a lot. Then out of nowhere came another soldier, and we were free. Now, we did not know that the Rwanda war was going to happen and that I was going to be incapable of communicating with my wife for about 6 months at a time, that she was going to be in a highly dangerous situation. She was shot at more than once. But neither she nor I can actually claim courage because neither of us ever felt any fear. That is not rational, but it happened. There is something beyond yourself. I think that's actually good news.
Do we have any questions for our panelists? I see somebody getting up, so running and running, that's good. Running is good.
This question is for Dr. Patrick, and it's not going to be a sentence long because that would be a dumb question then. So I wasn't going to ask about youth row, but that got covered. But if we take McIntyre's point and we say, okay, well, we don't want to think that it's just meaningless and we're going to go after ourselves, but now if we look at the culture in the States, you have maybe, okay, with the exception of Dawkins, you have a group of rational, reasonable people, and then this other group. And certainly there are people who are doing great things, you know, the Jesuit Catholic worker movement, you know. But on the other hand, you have Terry Jones, Dove World Outreach Center, and, you know, most of the probably the viewership of Fox News or whatever. And what they're full of hatred, right? So that doesn't seem like something that we'd want to – it seems like we'd want to base something on a rational, reasonable kind of thing that, say, the Catholic worker movement or yourself can share with people who are atheist.
Well, you know, the problem is actually an endarkment one. Because what the church has stupidly bought into is presenting what Jesus had to teach us in post-endarkment rationality terms. But you have to begin with something that doesn't fit there. What happened to Augustine in the garden changed the history of the Western world, but it was not explicable in those terms. When the children in the tree, a few houses down, said, "Open the book and read it, open the book and read it," they weren't talking to him, but he took it as a message to him. Open the Bible, that passage in Romans which described him, and his life changed. He ended up writing The City of God, which played a great part in the survival of Europe. At the end of his life, Aquinas, when he'd had achieved what must be one of the greatest intellectual achievements of all time in writing, or almost writing, the Summa, he never finished it, had a meeting with Christ in the chapel. And after that meeting with Christ, he never wrote another word in the few months that remained. And when asked why, he said, "It's all straw." That meeting with something beyond yourself is what needs to be talked about. And then, of course, the Bible is utterly rational. It says, when you have had this, what are you going to do with it? And the people you're talking about are not doing that. That's the problem. They think that Romans 12:2 says be renewed in your feelings. It doesn't. It says be renewed in your mind. And the church has lost the way of thought. But don't let those madcaps cause you to throw away truth. I frequently break the speed limit, I'm afraid. That doesn't make the speed limit stupid. It makes me a hypocrite.
Thank you, Dr. Patrick. Next question, please. Let's do try to keep to one question sentence and one sentence answer.
That's impossible.
All of you have very well articulated beliefs. My question is, how do you deal with when you can't live up to the belief that you know to be true for yourself? Sorry, more than one sentence. But everyone in this room has probably felt guilt before, and I was just wondering how you deal with that, and how does that go with the desire to enjoy all of life in the face of suffering of other people? How can you enjoy something when you know there's other people suffering at the cost of someone else, because our actions affect other people?
I'll go first because I can do it in one sentence. You practice repentance, you practice forgiveness, you practice restitution, and you join a group of people who will help you to do that.
Well, I can probably do one sentence too. You don't dwell too much on the guilt. You think more about how you can do better next time, how you can improve. And if you're on that upward trajectory, I think you can live with the fact that you're not doing everything you should be.
And Dr. Russell?
I agree with both of those suggestions. I have nothing to add.
Thank you. One last question.
Dr. Singer, I share with you the limitation and the perplexity of dealing with the inner life of the chameleon. You know, what's he thinking? What's his value? But I wonder if this whole, planning for the future is kind of the way to get the abortive child into the, elimination, the non-defective abortive child, suddenly doesn't have a plan for the future. Is that why that's there, or where did that come from? This, you have to have a plan for the future. I mean,
it comes from asking the question, what could justify thinking that it's worse to kill a normal human being, let's say one of us in this room, than to kill a dog or a pig or one of Dr. Patrick's cattle, or a chimpanzee for that matter? And I certainly think there is something, but I don't think it's membership of the species Homo sapiens, because I don't think you could defend drawing a moral circle around one particular species any more than you can defend drawing a moral circle around one particular race. And we surely don't want to do that. So there has to be some characteristics. Now, I'm open to the suggestion that I haven't picked on the right characteristics, or it's not a complete list, or there are other things that are important. But I think everyone has to say, what is it? If you do think it's worse to kill one of us than to kill one of Dr. Patrick's cattle, you have to say, well, why? What is it? And you have to give a coherent answer to that. And in the absence of belief in God, anyway, I think you have to give a coherent non-religious answer. And I agree with Professor Russell, incidentally, that even if you do think that we're immortal, that doesn't necessarily give you the kind of answer that people want.
I think we need to end it there because our panelists have to somehow have some lunch and then be ready to go at noon at the medical school, which is over a mile away. So let's give a final round of applause and appreciation to our panelists.